session number 29566, reel 12.
And Spicer, reel 12.
One other thing that I forgot to mention, we were introduced to the EY rifle, which was in fact an old type Lee Enfield rifle with what they used to call a grenade cup screwed on the end. What they did was, with the some of the old Lee Enfields, they put a thread on the end of the barrel, the sight end, and they made a metal container which had a thread also, and it screwed onto the muzzle of the rifle, and into that container you could put a 36 mils hand grenade. And what the guys used to do, you had usually had an EY rifleman in each patrol as well. Now his job was to have a primed grenade with the lever taken off and slipped into the the pin taken out and the grenade placed into the grenade cup. Now, by very nature of the grenade sliding snugly into the grenade cup, the clip didn't fly off. It was held in place. And what they used to do was get a black plastic bag, put it over the top of the grenade cup, and either have a piece of string or a very strong elastic band to wind round the end. Now, his job in the patrol was, if they hit a bunch of bandits that got away, sometimes they didn't actually fire on you, or you didn't fire on them, but they were seen, but they were scarpering off, the officer might say, if the area was clear enough, the EY rifleman would whip off his plastic carrier bag thing. He already had a round up the spout, but it wasn't an ordinary bullet. It was more like a blank. It didn't have the sharp end on, but it had a charge. He used to fire this thing, and the force used to propel the grenade out of the cup. And as soon as the grenade came out of the cup, of course, the clip flew off, and the grenade used to propel. It was like a handheld mortar, if you like. I don't think the trajectory was very high or the distance very far, but it used to point it in the general direction that these guys had run, and the grenade would fly off into the distance and explode. And that was a good way of trying to get somebody, you know, that had got away from you in close quarter.
Were you given a chance to fire that?
No,
or anything?
No.
So would it be always somebody who was designated within the patrol?
Yes.
But within your training, would they then explain that role?
They showed you the EY rifle and what its potential was, but they said, you know, it's not something we train you on, because once you join a duty company, either the patrol or company that you join will either have an EY rifleman, or if an EY rifleman is required, you will be given the necessary training at that time. The other thing that I forgot to mention, and this goes back right to when we arrived at Sagama, was we couldn't understand that all around the tent area, there were trenches about foot to 18 inches wide and about foot and a half deep. Because several blokes, when they got out of bed in the morning, they got outside the tent and they fell into these things. And they were known as monsoon trenches, which, it's certainly in the Far East, it's not just Malaya, but overall Far East area, certain times of the year is the monsoon season. And when it rains there, it's just like sheet glass. And you can patrol in monsoon. We adopted the same tactics in Malaya that Mountbatten adopted against the Japanese when he said, we don't stop at night. We don't fight because it's dark. But we, I mean, we didn't go to that extent, but because it rained, we didn't say, oh, bugger this, we're not going to patrol in. We patrolled through it. So you could be patrolling in absolute downpours. You would, it was just running off you. And then it would break, possibly, into bright sunshine, and within 10 minutes you would be dry because the steam would just rise off your body and off your uniform. It's absolutely amazing how it just evaporates. It's got to be seen to be believed. So we'd finished jungle training, and then we were posted to our companies. Now, in the battalion, like most infantry battalions, you have five companies. You have headquarter company, A company, B company, C company, and D company. Now, A, B, C, and D are usually rifle companies, and headquarter company is obviously the centre, the nerve centre of the rifle companies. Now, the rifle companies can be dispersed in various locations. And when we arrived in Sagama, in Johor, headquarter company was quite away from that location. I can't quite remember where they were exactly, but the training area was in Sagama itself. Now, the majority of the draft, and I think there were about 36 of us that came over, I would say probably between 15 and 20 of the original draft were posted to headquarter company, and they were given jobs like on the MT, because the MT section was classed as headquarter company. There were various people posted to the signal section, where they would take up a further training course of no more than possibly a week to a fortnight, because at that time the turnover of men was very brisk, and they would be trained as signallers to go out with patrols, and they used to carry a large pack radio in their back, and very heavy in those days. They were very large, not like the small ones they have now. There was people posted to the MI room, clerks. You may have got a couple went into the armoury, and obviously some were posted as batmen to officers, but the rest of them were farmed out between the four remaining rifle companies. Now, each rifle company had three platoons. So A company would have one platoon, two platoon, and three platoon, A company. B company, four, five, and six. C company, seven, eight, and nine. D company, 10, 11, and 12. And each platoon probably had something like between, at the maximum I would say at that time, 25 guys. Because at that particular time in the battalion's history, we were very under strength, because the battalion had come from Greece originally, and they were posted to Malaya in the very early part of 1949. And under Colonel White. And when they first arrived in Malaya, they went up country to Selangor State, to a place called Sungabezi. And they'd spent a few months there, and then the battalion had been brought down country again to Johor, which had quite, at that time, quite a reputation for bandit gangs. And that's where we joined it, at Sagama. And then, as I say, the chaps were posted out to their rifle companies, and all the lads that you'd seen through basic training went their own ways. So you may have come across them perhaps at odd times, but you started to get to the point where you had new relationships with different people, and it was surprising because that when you joined a platoon, you weren't an outsider at all. You were welcomed into the platoon. I mean, you were the new boy and you were learning all the time, but the guys that were with you sort of helped you along. It was fantastic. The camaraderie and the comradeship was fantastic. And although you were in a situation where you were, well, it was an active service situation, the atmosphere was totally different from basic training, in as much that it was much more relaxed. They knew that you were a trained soldier. I mean, you still had lots to learn in terms of all the wrinkles and bits and pieces of jungle technique, and you were helped along by the guys that had been there before you. But the officers and the NCOs, there was no bawling and shouting. They spoke to you in a civil way. I mean, you still obeyed the order. If a bloke said jump, you jump. But there was none of this, you know, 2 inches from your face, bawling their heads off. And it was, as I say, much more relaxed, but it was a very close-knit atmosphere, and everybody was looking after everybody else. And then, you know, you just went out on patrol, not day after day. You might get a couple of days off, and then you might be called together by your platoon commander, who invariably was a national serviceman anyway. He was a young lad, come out, perhaps he was on your draft, or he'd come out after you, usually a one pipper or even a two pipper. And, you know, he was as fresh-faced as you were. A lot of them, we used to take the mickey out of them because we said they couldn't read a map. And map reading was very, very difficult there because we didn't have up-to-date maps. We were still using maps that were used by troops during the Japanese occupation. So a lot of stuff was old hat. It was very much feely touchy. You know, you used to go out and you'd look at a map, or the officer or platoon sergeant would, and do a map reading with a compass. But in those situations, it's very, very difficult. You just have to sort of, you take pot luck, really. I mean, I must say, the majority of platoon officers and platoon sergeants were very good, because some of the platoon sergeants were older, obviously. Some of them had fought in the Singapore-Malay campaign against the Japanese in the early years, and obviously the battalion had been in Burma as well. And we had some of the senior officers had fought against the Japanese, so they knew not necessarily the terrain where we were, but they knew the jungle situation. So that was quite a help to us. But as I've explained before, you'd be called together, a platoon, perhaps of 15, 20, 25 guys, and the officer would say, okay lads, we're going out on a trip, it's going to last say 3 days, go to the stores, pick up your rations. I mean, we all knew what to take in terms of personal belongings, you know, your towel and your a bit of soap, and you didn't overburden yourself, change your clothes, obviously socks, your anti-malaria tablets and what have you, your cigarettes was a must out there, practically everybody smoked, blokes who didn't smoke before smoked then. And we picked up our compo ration packs. There was bully beef and hardtack biscuits and the usual sort of stuff, and we would put it in our small kit bag, stick it on our back, and then you would be called outside by the platoon sergeant or the corporal, and you'd all line up, maybe 15, 20 blokes all in a line, and they'd check your weapons. You would load all magazines in, one up the spout, safety catch on, and the transport would come up, either 3 tonners or 1,500 weights. Usually, if you were going a fair way out of the camp area, you may have a what we used to call a dingo scout car as escort, which was a Daimler scout car with twin Brins or twin Vickers mounted on top for escort. And the trucks that you went out on also had escorts on as well, so that when they dropped you off, they would obviously have personnel still on them, fully armed for the trip back. Because it had been known that the bandit situation out there, unless they were in a very, very strong position, they would not attack a fully loaded military convoy, although it has been known. I mean, the Royal West Kents did suffer a very nasty road ambush out there, and they lost quite a few guys. But they tended to shy away, but they would attack an empty convoy coming back. Or they would feel more inclined to have a go at them than a fully armed convoy. And then you would be dropped off at a location, perhaps along a mud track somewhere. You would try and avoid populated areas, because the jungle telegraph would start to come into operation. There was plenty of unarmed communist sympathisers living in settlements all around the jungle area edge. These were known as Minyun, and as soon as they saw a military convoy, they would get the old messages to the bandit gangs, the armed bandit gangs, who would either invariably move out of the area, or if they thought they had an easy target, they might try and lay an ambush, but it wasn't very often that they did that. And then you would just go into the secondary jungle. You might patrol through rubber, and then you would gradually work your way into the more dense region, and you would just patrol perhaps all day to a specified point. You know, again, map reference, compass readings to the best of the platoon commander's ability. Invariably they got you there, and they would look for a suitable area to camp overnight. Usually it was, you tried to get a clearing where you weren't overlooked, if there was water there or nearby so you could fill up your water bottles, and then you would make camp. You would post your guards first, and then the sergeant would call all the lads together and get all the food in, and either him or a senior NCO, another NCO, would calculate how much they needed for a particular meal, and then the rest would be divided out again so that everybody had a fair weight to carry. The tea was the first thing on the go, get a brew up going. And then with your ground sheet, you would make a sort of a bivouac. You would either put a piece of string in the two eyelet holes. If two or three blokes would bed in together, so you had one ground sheet on the jungle floor and one over the top, and either you strung it to the nearest tree so that you had a shelter, and then you would pile in there, and then you'd have your meal, and you'd have in a lot of cases, not all cases, you would lay trip flares around the camp area, and then all through the night you would have a constant change of guard. You had 2 hours on, 4 hours off, and it was, we knew it as stag duty, and this went on all the way around the clock until first light the following morning, when you had a condition known as stand to. Now, stand to is everybody is awake and everybody is looking outward from the camp area for at least 10 to 15 minutes. And this was just in case there was a surprise attack at first light. I mean, dawn is a very, very... it's a very uneasy time, because, you know, anybody that wants to attack anybody, not just in a jungle situation, but blokes are bleary eyed and half asleep. So stand to, you are fully awake, but you were just waiting for something to happen virtually, and then you were stood down. The sentries are still out, and then most blokes will get a brew up and perhaps breakfast, and then the sentries are brought in for their breakfast, and other guys would go out to take their place, and then they're a little while for clearing the camp area out altogether, so that there's absolutely no trace of your being there. I mean, all empty tins were buried. There was no actual latrines dug as such. You just, if you wanted to go to the loo, usually two of you went. One stood guard while the other one did the business. And this is how it worked. You were never, certainly in our battalion, I can't speak for other battalions, but our battalion certainly had this ethos of you never went anywhere on your tod. It was the same as if you hit a suspected bandit camp. You might be patrolling along, and the leading scout, who was 25 yards perhaps in front, he might suspect there was a bandit camp ahead. And bandit camps are very, very difficult to get into, because invariably they've got lookouts, and usually they either shout or fire the warning, and by the time you got in there they'd gone. But trying to get into a bandit camp is difficult, but the idea was that you got as close as you could, and then you took off your equipment in your small pack, and then two blokes were left with the packs, your packs, and the rest of the platoon did a flanking movement. You might have got some to the right, some to the left. There was very, very occasionally did you go in a full extended line, that the platoon was split into two. Platoon officer took one half, and the platoon sergeant took the other half, and you would go in from the right and the left. But unless you were very, very lucky, 9 times out of 10, you'd find the place empty. But you'd find they'd gone perhaps 5-10 minutes before you got there. The fire was still going. There was rice cooking on the fire in the pots. There was, you could see hammocks that were strung between the trees still swinging, and everything had just been left. In a lot of cases, they'd left packs behind, and this is where we got a lot of our information.
What types of things would be in the packs that were of use?
In the packs were medical supplies, photographs, family photographs, and from that, the police could, when these were taken back, all this stuff was handed over to the police, and from that they could buy family photographs. There might even be photographs of the actual person that the pack belonged to, because they were quite... how should I put it? They're quite vain, a lot of these bandits. They loved pictures of themselves with the three-corner khaki bandit hat on, with the stars on from their days when they fought against the Japanese. And these were posted up on the wall at the police station, and they had an index there, a file, and this went from one state to another, because in those days the Federation of Malaya was split up into about 10 or 11 states, but there was cooperation between the states and the different police areas, and they would come up with names, and then this is how they built up the picture of various bandit organisations, their platoons, their platoon strength, what arms they had. Sometimes you might be very lucky and capture somebody in one of these camps, either a bloke that wasn't very well, or, you know, he didn't have the wherewithal to scarper off. That was a bit unusual, but it has been known. And then what we used to do was some of the camps were quite sophisticated. They had training grounds, like a parade ground, all sort of mud, trampled down. They had a medical centre, believe it or not. This is all in a jungle area. There was tunnels, wash facilities. They were quite sophisticated, some of them, because a lot of them, you know, obviously had fought against the Japanese during the war, and they were well versed in jungle craft and all that sort of thing. And some of them, they had booby traps with the sharpened bamboo, so you had to be very careful sometimes. What we used to do was we just used to bury all the food. If we found tins of food, we used to puncture it and bury it. And all the outbuildings, we just used to set fire to them. We used to completely destroy the camp so it couldn't be used. We used to find all sorts of things. In a lot of them, you used to find really large hoards of medical supplies, which we destroyed as well. It's amazing the stuff that they did collect. Collected everything. 5-gallon drums and everything. Anything that they thought could be useful to them, they used to collect. It was like Steptoe's yards, some of the bandit camps, the stuff that we would class as junk, but they would find a use for it.
Would you find weapons?
Very occasionally. One or two instances we found very old weapons, Japanese weapons. But invariably, that was the first thing they used to grab when they were hightailing it out. They would leave their other stuff, their personal belongings behind.